for there.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukraine's president is preparing to visit Washington this week in what would be his first known trip outside the country since Russia's invasion started in February. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the Pentagon.
Three AP sources confirmed Vladimir Zelensky's highly sensitive trip, which they say could still be called off due to security concerns. The visit set to include an address to Congress Wednesday and a meeting with President Biden. Zelensky said in his nightly address, it's a key week for Ukraine to secure what it needs for the long winter fight. His visit comes as Congress is set to vote on a spending bill that includes about $45 billion in emergency aid to Ukraine, the biggest American infusion yet. Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
Afghanistan's Taliban-run higher education ministry on Tuesday suspended access to universities by female students until further notice, drawing strong condemnation from the United States, Britain, and the United Nations. UN spokesman Stefan Duharik called it another broken promise from the Taliban.
We have seen since their takeover, and also in the past months, just a lessening of the space for women. Not only in education, but access to public areas, their non-participation in the public debate.
Foreign governments, including the United States, have said a change in policies on women's education is needed before it can consider formally recognizing the administration. A parade to celebrate the Argentine World Cup champions was abruptly cut short as millions of people poured into the parade. This is VOA News. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is asking the Supreme Court to end asylum restrictions for migrants, but also asked the court for a delay until at least after Christmas. AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports.
Migrants have been denied rights to seek asylum under Public Health Rule Title 42 on grounds of preventing the spread of COVID-19. The federal government acknowledged in its response to the Supreme Court on the issue that the end of Title 42 will likely lead to disruption and a temporary increase in unlawful border crossings, but asked the court to reject efforts by a group of conservative-leaning states to keep Title 42 in place. Those states have warned of an unprecedented calamity at the southern border. With the decision on what comes next going down to the wire, pressure is building in communities along both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
An extradition hearing is set for Wednesday in the Bahamas for the founder of the collapsed cryptocurrency firm FTX. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Sam Bankman-Fried will have a hearing in a Bahamian court on his possible extradition to the U.S. in the coming days to face criminal charges related to the collapse of cryptocurrency exchange FTX. On Monday, Bankman-Fried's lawyer said he had agreed to be extradited to the U.S., but the necessary paperwork had not yet been written up. It's not clear when Bankman-Fried's extradition could occur once it is approved by the Bahamian court. U.S. prosecutors allege he played a central role in the rapid collapse of FTX and hid its problems from the public and investors. I'm Norman Hall.
The United Nations Security Council on Tuesday eased a weapons embargo meant to stem rebel fighting in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and renewed a peacekeeping mission there for another year. Under a new resolution, UN member states are no longer required to notify the Security Council of arms sales or military support to the Congolese government. Arms sales to non-government armed groups are still banned. U.S. law enforcement seized more than enough fentanyl to kill all Americans in 2022, the Drug Enforcement Administration said Tuesday, underscoring the deep threat of the deadly man-made opioid. The DEA said it had captured more than 50 million fake prescription pills laced with fentanyl and 10,000 pounds of fentanyl powder during the year, calling it the equivalent of, quote, more than 379 million potentially deadly doses. The DEA said fentanyl, which caused only a fraction of overdose deaths a decade ago, is now, quote, the deadliest drug threat facing this country. Find more on our website, VOANews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, December 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinadorfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. deploys strategic bombers in drills with South Korea as tensions escalate on the peninsula.
Generally speaking, North Korea has greatly increased its weapons tests, and the United States and its ally South Korea, in response, have increased their own shows of force.
Suspected militant gunmen kill at least 38 villagers in northwestern Nigeria.
According to Luca Biniet, a spokesperson for the Southern Kaduna People's Union, the attack started late on Sunday night and continued into the early hours of Monday morning.
And Thailand's Navy recovers bodies of six Marines as officials race against time to find survivors of a sunken warship. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The U.S. Air Force flew B-52 strategic bombers and F-22 fighter jets to South Korea for joint drills on Tuesday in their latest display of force against North Korea. The participation of the F-22 Raptor 5th-generation stealth fighters currently based in Japan's Okinawa was their first since May 2018 when the allies staged joint exercises in South Korea. The joint drills come hours after North Korea released statements condemning a Japanese military buildup outlined in a new security strategy, calling it dangerous and vowing counteractions, while also warning of another imminent test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. For more on the escalating tensions on the peninsula, I spoke with VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
Generally speaking, North Korea has greatly increased its weapons tests, and the United States and its ally South Korea, in response, have increased their own shows of force. That's basically what's happened this week. You saw North Korea conduct several tests. Most recently, it launched two medium-range ballistic missiles. North Korea described this as sort of final stage test for the country's first spy satellite. As part of that test, they released two images, satellite images, showing two South Korean cities, Seoul and Incheon. It's notable, though, that these images were of very low quality. In fact, you could go to Google Maps or really many different websites and find much better quality images. It doesn't seem that North Korea has at least tested a device that would allow it to spy in a really intrusive way on South Korea. However, North Korea released a statement yesterday saying, well, this was just a low image camera that you could do much better. In response yesterday, you also saw the U.S. actually fly nuclear-capable bombers near the peninsula. This is also considered an aggressive step by North Korea, so I think we'll probably see a response to that in the coming days as well. We're really sort of locked in a tit-for-tat sort of exchange here.
Is there an end game to this? And how long will this tit-for-tat, if you will, continue? Every expert indicates that North Korea might be testing a nuclear device anytime soon. If that happens, what is likely to be the response of both allies, the United States, North Korea, and even Japan?
The U.S. and South Korea have said for months now, really for over 6 months, that North Korea is in the final stages of testing a nuclear device. This would be its seventh nuclear test since 2006. It would be highly provocative, of course. The U.S. and South Korea, its allies, also in Japan, elsewhere, would condemn this test. I don't know how China and Russia would respond. That would be the big question here. However, sure that this would raise regional tensions to a point that is very high. Is this sort of the peak of what the tensions would be? You know, where do these tensions end? That's a big question. But related to that is, what does North Korea want out of this? Why is it testing so many missiles, more than it ever has before? Why would it conduct a nuclear test? These are questions that are honestly a little bit difficult to answer, because in the past, North Korea has ramped up nuclear and missile tests in order to intentionally raise tensions on the peninsula, to sort of force the United States back to negotiations, to gain more leverage in those negotiations. But right now, you're really seeing North Korea say, no, we don't want talks. We just want to test our weapons. So I think a big motivation for this, for them, is just to get better weapons to deter the United States. And maybe eventually it will re-enter negotiations, and it will think that it has a better negotiating stance. But for now, it really seems that we are locked in, because of North Korea's posture here, sort of a situation in which North Korea will continue to do this for the foreseeable future. And the United States and its allies feel they have no choice but to, you know, respond with shows of major force.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from the South Korean capital. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited the eastern city of Bakhmut, the scene of some of the most intense combat since Russia invaded. He met Tuesday with troops and praised what he called their, quote, resilience and strength, unquote, as artillery boomed in the background. For his part, Russian President Vladimir Putin hailed the, quote, courage and self-denial, unquote, of his forces in Ukraine, but he did so at a ceremony in an opulent and glittering Kremlin hall. Both leaders sought to build morale as the stalemated conflict grinds through its 10th month and winter approaches. The World Health Organization warns increasing Russian attacks on Ukraine's electricity grid and other critical infrastructure are putting the lives of healthcare professionals and thousands of patients at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Ukraine's health system is resilient, but WHO officials say hospitals and clinics cannot function when they lack electricity and water. Speaking from the capital, Kyiv, the WHO representative in Ukraine, Yano Habich, says Russia has attacked more than 700 healthcare facilities since it invaded Ukraine on February 24th. These assaults on healthcare, he says, have adversely affected facilities, supplies, and transport, injuring and killing healthcare workers and patients.
This marks a clear violation of international law. Health should never be a target. Amid ongoing attacks, WHO continues to deliver life-saving medical supplies throughout the country. And these supplies and interventions have saved lives. And WHO is here, as many others, to deliver care and to save lives as we go further.
Habich says the WHO, in coordination with Ukraine's health ministry and partners, has delivered medicines, trauma kits, power generators, and other supplies, mainly to frontline and newly recaptured areas. He says up to 9 million people have been reached, adding many more will need help to survive Ukraine's harsh winter. He warns freezing temperatures will increase the risk of respiratory, infectious, and cardiovascular diseases. He says ongoing attacks on energy and heating infrastructure will decrease the availability of healthcare services. He adds people are likely to endanger themselves as they struggle to stay warm and heat their homes.
As people resort to alternative sources of heating for their homes, such as coal and wood, and using diesel fuel generators or electric heaters, we see the risk of carbon monoxide poisoning will increase, as well the other risks.
Besides its serious physical impact, he says the war is also creating enormous mental distress. He says WHO estimates up to 10 million people are at risk of some form of mental disorder. Habich says WHO has a team of more than 200 personnel delivering supplies and healthcare services to tens of thousands of people in eight priority areas. He says there are no plans to halt these life-saving operations during the holiday season. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And despite pressure from Western countries, India has remained steadfast in its partnership with Russia, refusing to condemn the war in Ukraine and not joining Western sanctions against Moscow. However, as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, this has not affected its growing ties with the United States.
As the Ukraine conflict raged, India refused to pick sides between its Western partners and Russia. On a visit to Moscow last month, India's foreign minister said New Delhi will bolster economic ties with its Cold War ally.
For us, Russia has been a steady and time-tested partner. And as I said, any objective evaluation of our relationship over many decades would confirm that it has actually served both our countries very, very well.
New Delhi has not joined Western sanctions and has also increased its purchases of discounted Russian crude oil, coal and fertilizers. It has abstained from United Nations resolutions condemning Moscow over its aggression. Analysts say with India's military heavily dependent on tanks, fighter jets and other equipment of Russian origin, it could not afford to isolate Moscow. But the escalation in the Ukraine conflict, such as strikes by Russia on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, is causing concern in New Delhi. In September, Prime Minister Narendra Modi told Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of a regional summit that this is not an era of war. Significantly, an annual summit held regularly between the Russian and Indian leaders has not been scheduled this year. India's stand on Russia has, however, not strained ties with the United States, as some had feared. With an eye on China, both countries stepped up their strategic partnership this April.
Today, we are positioning the U.S. and Indian militaries to operate and coordinate closely together across all domains and increasingly across the wider Indo-Pacific.
Indian and U.S. armies held joint exercises close to India's border with China last month. Having good relations with both the West and Russia, analysts say in the coming months, India hopes to play a constructive role in any efforts to end the armed hostilities in Ukraine. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong flies to China on Tuesday, signalling an improvement in bilateral relations. There have been friction between Beijing and Canberra over various geopolitical issues and the origin of COVID-19. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Relations between Australia and China have been cool for several years. There have been disagreements over democracy in Hong Kong, human rights in China's Xinjiang province and Taiwan. In response, China imposed restrictions on a range of Australian commodities, including wine and barley. Beijing was accused of economic coercion, while claims of anti-China hysteria were made against Australia. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong's trip to Beijing this week is another sign that tensions are easing. She'll meet her Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. The visit will coincide with the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two countries. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said in a statement Monday that while Australia sought stability and cooperation with China, its biggest trading partner, there would also be disagreements. William Stoltz is policy director at the National Security College at the Australian National University. He told VOA Monday that Canberra would be seeking an honest yet robust relationship with Beijing.
There are going to be things that Australia, United States and other liberal democracies simply won't be able to agree with China on, but that needn't consume the entirety of the relationship, and that if we are kind of clear and calm and deliberate in saying to the Chinese, these are the things that we can work with you on and these are the things that we can't, then that at least is a basis for tensions to stay below a certain threshold and for a constructive relationship to exist.
In May, Australia elected a centre-left Labor government. It's been looking to mend ties with the country's most important trading partner. In November, Albanese met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. The last time an Australian minister travelled to China was when former Trade Minister Simon Birmingham visited in November 2019. Foreign Affairs Minister Wong said Tuesday that her trip to Beijing would not immediately resolve issues between the two countries. She also said that she would push for the lifting of trade sanctions and the release of Australian citizens detained in Beijing. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, Thailand's Navy discovered the bodies of six Marines on Tuesday after a small warship sank in treacherous waters at the weekend. The military raced against time to find survivors, mobilizing helicopters, warships and unmanned drones off its central coast. Around two dozen Marines were still unaccounted for by Tuesday afternoon. Some of those missing were without life vests. The Navy's chief of staff also said he was hopeful there will be more survivors after one person was found alive after 41 hours. Dozens were forced to abandon the HTMS Sukhothai late on Sunday after it was knocked over by 13-foot waves and strong winds. The U.S.-made corvette, in use since 1987, was carrying 105 military personnel. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Gunmen killed at least 38 villagers in northwestern Nigeria's Kaduna State Residents and local community groups said on Tuesday, a region chronically marred by armed violence. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
According to Luca Biniet, a spokesperson for the Southern Kaduna People's Union, the attack started late on Sunday night and continued into the early hours of Monday morning. Armed men shot people and burned at least 100 houses, he said. Resident Jason Joseph said the attackers had killed some people with machetes.
Even though I didn't lose my child, my mother, but I lost my uncles, my brothers, my friends, everywhere around. If you go down there, the two streets now, you see cops everywhere lying down.
Biniet said 12 survivors from the attacks were receiving hospital treatment and volunteers were searching for those missing. Gangs of armed men have attacked hundreds of local communities across northwestern Nigeria in recent years, while Islamist militants continue to stage attacks in the northeast. A Nigerian police spokesman did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters. And the, quote, loss and damage, quote, and fund agreed to last month at the COP27 climate conference aims for rich nations to help those who have borne the brunt of their global warming emissions. In Niger, climate change has fueled desertification and conflict as communities compete for dwindling resources. Henry Wilkins visits a community that is demonstrating how more funding can make a difference and speaks to the country's environment minister.
It's often said those least responsible for climate change will suffer the most because of it. This is especially true in Niger. According to non-profits such as Concern International, Niger, along with its neighbours in Africa's Sahel region, is likely to see a 3 to 6 degree Celsius increase in temperatures by the end of the century, with devastating impacts for one of the poorest and most difficult to farm regions on Earth. Yet, in 2021, Niger produced just 0.007% of global emissions. The change in climate is also adding to a rise in militant groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, according to the United Nations. Jean-Noël Gentil is the UN's World Food Programme Niger Country Director.
Climate change is contributing to the deterioration of natural resources, with population competing then for the same natural resources that are shrinking. So there is a direct correlation between climate change and security.
To help countries like Niger, a loss and damage fund was agreed upon at the UN's recent COP27 climate conference in Egypt. In theory, richer countries and bigger emitters of greenhouse gases will pay to assist the countries suffering from climate change the most. Non-profits say the cost of the damage caused by climate change could hit $1.8 trillion by 2050. Niger's Environment Minister, Garama Saratu Rabiu Inusa, told VOA the fund needs to become operational quickly. She says there's an urgency to make the funds operational. Not only making the funds operational, she says, but also the urgency to make the funds available through an easy funding mechanism that favours countries such as Niger. Hawa Koba Maigaradi lives in a village in Niger's border region with Nigeria, an area that could benefit from the fund. A project run by the World Food Programme has reorganised the village's farming practices, allowing them to farm during the dry season in addition to the rainy season. She says food production has increased and the older and younger generations of the village no longer have to go elsewhere to find work, since they can grow crops twice in a year. It's an improvement because there is now not only enough food to survive, but also enough to sell, she adds. In a neighbouring village where there is no assistance, a farmer says they do not have enough to eat. Environmentalists say that details such as how the fund will work and how money will make it to villages like those in Zindare need to be nailed down. Steve Trent is with the Environmental Justice Foundation, a UK-based environmental non-profit.
The political pitfalls are developing states just decide not to pay. And it's hard when you want to get governments to write that check. It's difficult to get them to do it, particularly in the economic climate that we face globally now.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change declined to give an interview on how the fund might work and how long it may take to become active. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Zindare, Niger.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol referred former President Donald Trump to the Department of Justice on four charges, including aiding the insurrection. This and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next up, please join me for the best of Encounter 2022, from Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, including war crimes against civilians, to women-led protests in the Islamic Republic of Iran. You will hear excerpts from the most memorable programs of the year. The Best of Encounter 2022, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 14th, the United Nations Economic and Social Council voted to expel Iran from the Commission on the Status of Women. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said the impact of this action will reverberate across the globe and stressed this effort led by the United States answers the call of civil society voices in Iran. The historic action was taken in response to the Iranian regime's systematic repression of women and girls and to the regime's brutality against peaceful protesters who have taken to the streets throughout Iran, triggered by the death in police custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in September. The Iranian government probably thought Mahsa's death would be just another statistic, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
But this time was different. Two brave women reporters, Niloufar Hamedi and Ilahe Mohammadi, told her story. And when the people of Iran heard it, they said enough was enough. Iranian women and men across ethnicities and social classes stood up to protest. They have demanded their basic human rights. They have come together through a simple rallying call: women, life, freedom.
In an unsuccessful attempt to suppress the voices of the Iranian people, over the past 3 months, the government has detained and tortured thousands of peaceful protesters, killed hundreds, and enacted harsh sentences, including the death penalty, following sham trials. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said in a statement that the vote to expel Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women is another sign of the growing international consensus on Iran and demands for accountability. Among other actions, he pointed to last month's welcome decision of the UN Human Rights Council to set up a fact-finding mission to investigate the Iranian regime's brutal actions against its own people, and to the December 8th joint statement by 9 countries condemning the targeted online harassment and abuse by Iranian authorities against women protesters. He called for the pursuit of all mechanisms of accountability against the Iranian regime and its officials for the atrocities they have committed. After the vote on Iran's removal from the Commission on the Status of Women, Ambassador Thomas Greenfield called the day a great one. "We stood up for Mahsa. We stood up for women. We stood up for life. And we stood up for freedom."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.